Today is Tuesday, November 17th, 2020. This is a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Pat Gredigan, spelled G-R-E-D-I-A-G-I-N. My name is Tom Martin. Afternoon, Pat. How are you today?
I'm doing well, thanks.
Great. Good to hear it. Pat, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes, you may.
Thank you. Pat, what year were you born?
1955.
And where were you born?
In Northern California.
Okay. There's a lot of Northern California. Is there a town?
I know. Yeah, in Eureka.
Okay.
Sometimes I get a little worried about, you know, how much personal info might get out into the who knows where, but that's,
okay.
I'm sure that's out there already.
Okay. How did your dad meet your mom?
They met while skiing in college. So
okay.
They both went to college in Eureka, and there was a small ski area in the Coast Range just to the east, and there was a college lodge, and there was my dad and his buddies had built a ski lodge, and so they crossed paths there.
1955? No, did they meet before?
Right.
Okay. When did they meet?
Like, I think 52, maybe, something like
that.
Wow. I think they got married in 53.
They were early into skiing.
Yeah, right.
Huh.
Yeah, my mom had skied when she was young on the East Coast where she lived.
Wow.
I don't know what, you know, I think my dad just... with his buddies, decided they're going to figure out how to ski, and they actually built a little rope tow with a Jeep motor that would run, and there would be a pulley, and they strung a big rope around and had this little rope tow that they set up on their own. So it was this do-it-yourself thing
mm-hmm.
for a little ski area. And so that's how they met, and then that became a place in the winter we would go skiing up the ski lodge, stay at the lodge with some of his friends and ski during my first 10 years or so. And then we moved to Oregon. So
okay.
We continued skiing, but it wasn't there anymore.
Your mom and dad were in college. What were they studying?
My mom became a teacher, so I guess she studied education.
Okay.
And my dad... had a major in wildlife management, something like that. But he didn't use that. He ended up deciding he didn't want to sit in a box somewhere and count people's ducks when they came out of the refuge or something like that. And so he ended up in California being a timber cruiser. He always liked to be outside. So he was a timber cruiser. And then when we moved to Oregon when I was 9, he... became self-employed and just built houses from beginning to end.
Oh, wow.
That we would live in for a while, and then he'd start another house, and we'd rent the first house, and we'd move into the half-finished second house, and he'd continue working on that, and then he'd start another one the next year. So it was that kind of occupation.
Oh, that's kind of neat. So he was basically, he'd build a house. You guys would stay in it until he got the next house going and built, and then he'd move you there and sell.
Right.
Right.
When it was half constructed, we'd move into the next house, which worked out well when you've got a bunch of young girls who like to pound nails on the walls to hang up their jackets and stuff. So that was...
Well, that's fun.
It was great, and he was home. He worked at home. So
okay.
So if we wanted to come home for lunch or something, we could come home, and Dad was there, you know, working on the house somewhere. So, yeah, it worked out well.
Nice. And did you have brothers and sisters?
I have 2 sisters, and I'm the oldest of the 3 of us. No
okay.
brothers.
All right. And so then you were in school there in Northern California and then up in Oregon. Did you all do the station wagon summer vacation thing? Did you camp out
yeah.
as kids?
Yeah, we did. We camped a fair amount, and we did this epic, in my mind, trip as a 15-year-old. One summer, because my mom had summers off, we took the station wagon and a little tent trailer and the dog and the three girls and the mom and dad in a little Ford Falcon station wagon, and we drove around the U.S. and
wow.
took 2.5 months to do that.
Wow.
And I can remember going into the desert area. We hiked into Havasu when I was 15.
Okay.
And camped down there. So we did a backpacking trip there.
Wow. So this would have been 1970.
Yep. 1970. And I became really, I loved deserts. Right from the beginning, I was enchanted by the notion of deserts. Well, I was living in Western Oregon, and it was long, gray winters, and I just decided the sunny, drier climates were really appealing to me, and that's where I did end up spending most of my working career, and I'm still very fond of deserts. So
okay.
I think it started with that trip.
What do you remember about hiking into Havasu in 1970?
Well, I'll tell you what I remember. My sisters and I were loving the idea of going swimming and getting, you know, when you're a young teenage girl, you're like to sunbathe and swim and explore. So we liked that. But my dad, even though he had spent much of his childhood and young adulthood and then married life with these camping trips on his own when he was younger or with us, he never got in the habit of carrying water.
Ooh.
And you didn't need it so much in Oregon or Northern California. So we hiked into Havasu, and mostly I remember the hike out, which it was June. It was really hot. He wisely thought, okay, we should at least wait till dark and hike out in the evening because it was, you know, stinking hot. But we didn't carry much water with us, just, you know, something he wasn't used to or didn't think through.
Mm.
And I can remember getting to the top, and we had this 5-gallon jug of water in our tent trailer, which was like 98 degrees hot.
Yeah.
And we just slugged that stuff down. It was the most awful stuff, but we were really quite thirsty. So I do remember that quite well as the fact is there was a rattlesnake in the trail. One of my sisters and I kind of went ahead of the other sister, mom and dad. And I don't think we had a flashlight. And there was a snake crossing. Oh, well, a rattlesnake rattled in
uh-huh.
the trail ahead of us. So we stopped, and we're like, oh, my gosh, what are we going to do? And we finally figured out to toss, because there was a little bit of moonlight, but not, and there were shadows. So you can kind of see some stuff. So we tossed pebbles in the direction of the sound, and then it made the snake move, and we could see it when it moved. So then we knew where it was, so then we went around it and continued on our way, but that was memorable as well.
Yeah, gosh. So did you go swimming and go down to the falls and camp in the campground?
Yep, at below Havasu Falls, as I remember, there was a campground.
It was operated by the National Park Service at that time.
Was it?
Yeah, it was before the 1975 Enlargement Act.
Wow. Well, I didn't know, you know, at that time, I didn't pay any attention to who operated it, but that's really interesting.
Yeah, no, that's, did you see a ranger down there? Did you see anyone? Did you talk to any of
the... I don't remember.
Okay.
I don't remember.
And this was part of a 2.5-month tour around the country. Did you like go down the western coast and then into the deserts and off to the east coast and back up across the
yeah.
northern part of the country?
Right.
Okay.
So we went south and then east and went through Florida. My mom's grandmother was in Florida, so she was in a nursing home. We only visited very briefly there, and then we went up the east coast and went to Washington, D.C. and saw Fiddler on the Roof.
Wow.
No, that was in New York City. We saw Fiddler on the Roof. And then up into the Maine and New Hampshire area where my mom had grown up. And then across the northern tiers back to back to Oregon. Yeah, it was great. And I can remember being very curious, like I was an explorer, and I kept a journal, and I'd say, okay, the landscape is changing from trees to more grasslands here. Oh, there's cactus now. And, you know, I was just into what I was seeing.
Okay. Was that your first time out of Oregon and California?
I don't think it was the first time out of Oregon. I had an uncle and relatives in the state of Washington.
Okay.
I know we went to Yellowstone when I was...
Okay.
I think, you know, before that, when I was... I think it was before that big trip. We mostly stayed in Oregon for our outdoor activities and our weekends and our trips, but we did have relatives in Washington and in California still, so we would sometimes do family trips to visit relatives. And I guess the Yellowstone trip was the main one that wasn't in Oregon, that was, and also not a family-oriented trip.
Okay. Did you all camp out then in Oregon in the summers?
Yeah.
Okay.
Right, yep.
And did you learn to swim?
I did. So I dog paddled, basically, when I was young with family. We'd be camping or swimming in or at a lake or something, and I knew how to dog paddle. I don't know if I knew how to really swim more than that then, but then when I was in junior high, our PE classes had swimming as part of the curriculum. So we actually had swimming lessons as a class.
Okay.
But that's probably where I learned to be a little more proficient with it.
Okay. Did you like sports? Did you get into sports at all?
Yes. I was always basically pretty athletic, as were both of my sisters and my parents. And,
okay.
So I participated in track when I was in junior high, and then when I was in junior high, there was some good opportunities for girls, and I think I was on a little basketball team when I was in eighth grade or something like that.
Cool.
And we moved to a different town. We were those years were in Philomath, Oregon. Philomath.
Thank you.
And then we moved to Albany in my high school years, and they didn't have as good a programs for women's sports. I never a tennis player, and so I can't remember what I did there. Maybe I played soccer a little bit. I just sort of dabbled in some of those kinds of things. Never did a whole lot of formalized sports, but my sisters or our family, we skied. And we hiked. So
okay.
That would have been more of the routine or regular things that I did throughout my life.
So thinking about going back to that trip when you were 15, from Havasu, you most likely would have then gone on to the south rim of Grand Canyon?
Well, I'm trying to remember if we actually went to the south rim. I'm not sure we did, and I don't know why we wouldn't have. But I can remember... that we camped at Boulder Beach in Nevada.
Okay.
And I was, it was a beautiful evening, and the moon was full, and I thought, and there was palm trees. I thought, oh, my God, this is heaven. And then I know we camped somewhere south of Flagstaff out, is it Lake Mary?
Yep.
Kind of to the south.
Mm-hmm.
I think we were out there somewhere in a Forest Service campground.
Okay.
And then I remember being in Lyman Lake, which is over on the east part of the state, I think.
Okay.
Maybe south of or north of Snowflake or whatever.
Yeah.
Somewhere in that area. And so I'm not sure if we would have had time. I don't remember the South Rim.
Okay.
So I'm not sure we went there.
Okay. All right. Did you like high school? Were you interested in school? And
yeah.
What did you enjoy about it?
Really learning, I guess. I was a good student. and I just sort of lapped up information and, you know, schooling. And I had some girlfriends and, you know, in high school a boyfriend, but I'm not sure that it was the social thing so much as just the opportunity to study and learn, I guess. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure, but it seems to me that's more dominant in my mind than seeing friends.
Okay. Were you thinking about going to college? Was that something that was sort of expected or encouraged in your family?
It was encouraged. I guess it was encouraged. It was not heavily. It wasn't like you will go. This is, you know, you must do this.
Okay.
It was, you make good decisions, and we expect you're going to make good decisions in your life, and college, you know, is probably something that's going to work right out for you. And so I don't remember that I ever thought that I wouldn't go to college, but it did feel like it was my choice. It wasn't that my parents dictated it to me.
And what were you interested in at time? You know, college sort of focuses people in a way on some things. It doesn't have to, but it can.
Yeah. Well, when I was really unfocused when my first year, other than I grew up near Oregon State. Philomath is near Corvallis,
okay.
Oregon State. And then I wanted to go live on my own. So, you know, I wanted to get away from home,
mm-hmm.
just because of the adventure of it. So I went to a college in Southern Oregon. At the time, it was Southern Oregon College, and now I think it's Southern Oregon University in Ashland.
Okay.
Because they had a ski area there, and, you know, it wasn't living at home, so I went there and just did some general kinds of studies. Well, actually, I was in this experimental program that was called Living Learning, where they gave you credit for learning through living things versus sitting in a classroom. Being lectured to.
Okay.
And so there was maybe 100 of us that were in a dorm, and we could write some of our own classes and say, I want to study this, and this is how I'm going to do it. And we had some advisors that would approve it or not. But there also were other things that the advisors thought of and had classes or offered. And one of the things that came up was that they would give us credit if we went and lived in another country.
Ooh.
And I was like, cool. My mom's parents had spent time overseas, and I also thought that sounded great. And so when I learned that they would give me credit to go and live in Israel on a kibbutz for 6 months, and I'm not Jewish, but it was just a chance to go live in somewhere else for 6 months, and it was going to cost the same thing as if I went to school in Ashland, because my lodging was paid for there, or I didn't have to pay for lodging, because we would work 4 hours a day, and then we'd have schooling 4 hours a day in this program that was really an intake program for people who are immigrating to Israel.
Okay.
But Southern Oregon gave me credit to go there for 6 months, so I got language credit and cultural credits and sociology credits and, you know, just kind of things that would cover an experience like that.
And did you go?
I did go.
Tell me all about it. I mean, how old were you? You would have been 18, 19?
I graduated from high school when I was 17, and I went the fall of my sophomore year, so I was 17. I think I was 18.
Okay.
And I went in October, and there was a couple of, I think there was three others from this program that were in the same kibbutz I was on, so I kind of knew a couple people, but there was a lot of young people from all of international young people that were there. Some people were immigrating into Israel, but some people were just volunteering to live on the kibbutz. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, they were from Germany or Switzerland or a guy that was an immigrant was from Russia, so it was a very international cast there of characters,
Great.
but probably 50% American or Canadian, I think.
Okay.
And so, well, one of the most interesting things is we got there in October of 1973, and I remember people saying to me before I left, oh, aren't you afraid, you know, because of the conflicts between the Israelis and the Syrians and the and Jordan. And I said, oh, no, not really. Well, 3 weeks later, the Yom Kippur War broke out when I was there. And so what I can remember happening was that the men from the kibbutz left because they had to go and fight in the war. We had blackouts, so we had stuff on the windows so we wouldn't have lights. The kibbutz I was on was maybe 60 or 80 miles south of the Golan Heights, and we would have air raid sirens that we were supposed to go into the bomb shelter if there was a plane that came our way. But one of the tasks, I had a lot of different jobs while I was there, but one of them was to hoe cauliflower, and we'd be out in the field, and we'd hear the air raid siren go off, and the guy that was our overseeing us, he'd say, yeah, just ignore that. I think once we might have gotten an air raid siren or a shelter, but not that. You know, there were several times that we didn't go. And I'm pretty sure that one time I was just gazing off towards the north, towards where the Golan Heights were in the distance, and I saw this bright flash of light. And what I interpreted at the time that I saw was that of a plane being hit and going down.
Wow.
So I, you know, I felt like we were kind of like I was kind of in a country that was war because of a lot of different things, but at the same time, my daily life wasn't very altered.
Okay.
So that was interesting. And then that resolved like within a week or two, and life kind of went back to normal, although one of our teachers lost one of her son died in the war, so that was...
Mm.
You know, that was really unfortunate. But mostly we would work 4 hours and then have class for 4 hours. And there was a great cast of young people there that would get into mild trouble together, having parties and things like that. So, and we took a couple field trips to Jerusalem and different places. And on some of our days off, I remember going to Jerusalem on the local bus. And spending a night there and wandering around. So that was pretty much the experience. And then I came back in the spring and went back to Ashland. And that was, and then finished up school, I think spring term there, I guess. And then I ended up needing to move back to Corvallis because I no longer had enough money to live in Ashland. So I lived in my mom's apartment. My parents had separated at that time, and I lived with her in Corvallis and went to school at Oregon State for another 2.5 years because they didn't accept all. So I ended up studying recreation at Oregon State.
Okay.
And got a degree in recreation, but it took me an additional half a year over. So it was 4.5 years because not all the credits that I had from Ashland were transferable or counted towards my major, so I had to stay another extra 2 terms, I guess, to get everything wrapped up.
Is that recreation planning or?
Well, they called it recreation management.
Okay.
Or they called it resource/recreation management. And there were several options, but the option that I was in was how to be a park ranger, basically. It was interpretation.
Oh, really? Okay.
And it really was how to be a park ranger, because when I was – I had to focus on that when I was my first years in college, but I had an incident when I was – before I got to Oregon State where I was backpacking with my, I think it was my dad and my sisters, and I, and maybe I was somewhere like in my 16, 17, 18, I don't know how old I was, but in my mid to later teens, and we were in the Cascade Mountains in Oregon, and this young woman came up to us, backpacking along with a uniform on, and she asked to see our permit. And it was a Forest Service, they called them Wilderness Guards, I think, at the time. And they just checked to make sure you had the permit. And then she walked off, and I said, wow, she gets paid to do that.
Cool.
That's what I want to do. Well, it, that idea got planted in me. And after I hung out in Ashland for a few years and didn't really have a focus, I thought, okay, well, I guess I better need to, I need to focus on something, and I guess I'll go to Oregon State and get a degree in how to be a park ranger.
And your dad, you mentioned that your dad had gotten a degree in wildlife management.
Right.
So that you would have had some familiarity through it, you know, with your family.
Yeah. Yeah. So wildlife is harder to see than trees. And,
yeah.
What I remember mostly learning from my dad was he taught me a lot of different trees.
Oh.
Because he had worked as a forester. And so we would be driving from Corvallis across the mountains to Bend, Oregon, which is where I now live, but that's where we would base to go skiing.
Okay.
In the winter, or to go, we'd go up in the mountains in the summer, and you get bored when you're a kid, and so I'd start saying, well, what's that tree, Dad? Well, what's that tree? And after a while, it got reversed, and he'd, because I started learning the trees, and he would say, well, what's that tree? And
cool.
Say, oh. Yeah, so I remember being interested in learning about what trees were, or, you know, different plants, through him. I don't think I learned too much about wildlife through him, but, you know.
Okay.
That's big, yeah.
But certainly that concept of resource management, recreation management, seemed to fit there. Yeah.
It was a good fit with me. I don't know that I particularly cared as much about. No, I loved learning. So my courses were a lot of introductory courses to a lot of things, like introduction to oceanography, botany, wildlife. Because they were preparing people to go out and have a fundamental understanding of how the natural world works so you could get a job as a park ranger and give interpretive naturalist programs in Oregon, in, you know, wherever you ended up. It wasn't really geared for Oregon, so they wanted to just give you a smattering of this is the basic stuff. And I loved learning all that basic stuff about different natural subjects.
Ecotypes, ecoregions. Flora, fauna.
Okay. And, but what I think was most attractive to me was the idea of just being out. And so when I got a job in Canyonlands, I graduated from college. I got a job in. No, I better back up. I graduated in March, 1977. And I didn't have a job, so I was like, "Oh, now what am I going to do?"
Well, hang on a second. Before you graduate, how did you work it out financially? Did you get summer jobs? Did you get jobs throughout the year when you were working through college? Or
yeah,
okay. Scholarships?
So my parents helped me. They said they'd help with the first couple years with. You know, it didn't cost as much to go to college then.
Yeah.
And I had a summer job at a hamburger stand my last year of college and saved up $1,000.
Whoa.
Really rich. And so between my money and my parents' money, and then I did work in Ashland at the ski area, actually, at the restaurant, the ski area. So I had some jobs and it all. And then in the summer, I worked at a resort in the Cascades. And then when I went to Oregon State, I did get a small scholarship and what they called work study.
Yep.
Where you worked on on campus for different places. So I worked during college as well as the summers between, during summers.
Okay. All right. So you were working out the finances as well. It's like, okay, we need to kind of, you know, save and work and
right.
Yeah. So
right. So I never had to have student loans, which was great. But I graduated poor. You know, everybody probably people graduate poor or in debt, and at least I was on the only poor end of it, not in debt, so that was good.
Right, right. You know, you graduated and was ready for a job, and had a little bit of money saved up. Did you have a car by then?
Well, I guess I did. I don't remember. I must have had a car my senior year. I don't remember. I know I had a car because I drove to Utah. But I can't remember quite when I had one. I guess I might have had one the last year or year and a half of college, because before that I had lived close enough that I could walk to campus. But I did have a car by the end of Volkswagen Bug.
Okay.
And so I graduated. Can I? Do you have any other questions before I launch into that phase?
No, I think we're ready to go. Just trying to paint a picture of, you know, what you were interested in, you know, how you what kind of outdoor skills you had, and
sure.
You know, so this is nice, and this is in the spring of 1977. You're graduating with a degree in recreation management,
right? With the environmental interpretation was my option or focus.
Oh, okay.
But I had no job, but I had seen these flyers for something called Student Conservation Association, and the job would be to be a student conservation aide, which was SCA, commonly called an SCA. And this flyer said that Ken Inlands National Park in southeast Utah was looking for some SCAs to work there. Starting in March. And so I saw that, and I knew I was going to be graduating in March. And so I said, aha, I'm going to apply because I love the desert. I love the idea of going to a desert, working in a park, and I don't have a job anyway. And this was a volunteer stint for 3 months where I would not go broke, but I wouldn't make money.
Okay.
So covered my expenses. They covered travel expenses to Canyonlands and back home. They gave me a stipend for food. The park provided housing. They gave me a uniform. And then, so essentially they covered expenses. And,
like a per diem kind of thing.
Yeah, like a per diem thing for food and stuff. They didn't, you know, if I wanted to go skiing on a weekend, that was my dollar. So I applied to that and got offered a job as a backcountry ranger in the Mays District of Canyonlands.
Wow.
That's what I said. Wow. You mean I get to get, well, I didn't get paid for hiking around in the desert, but I got to go do it. So I thought, that sounds great. And I accepted. And I drove, actually, I think I ended up finishing my finals early. I didn't go to any kind of graduation, which it didn't matter to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I drove to Utah, and I started my job as SCA in the Mays. We started with a week of training, so I got to know some of the other, for the whole park, so I met people who were working in other districts as well.
Okay.
And a lot of them were like in the Needles or based out of Moab.
Right.
But I got to know a few people, which was nice, so that when I had days off, I could go into Moab and, you know, sleep over at somebody's house that was also, you know, my peer, basically a seasonal person or a SEA. And then we decided to go for a hike together. And it became a pool of people that I did a lot of recreational stuff with over time.
Okay.
So I was in,
just thinking about the lay of the land here, Canyonlands encompasses the Green River and the Colorado River. They meet at a place called the Confluence and then head down into Cataract Canyon. And on the east side of the river is the Needles District, is that right? And on the west side, sort of the Green and the Colorado side is the Maze, is that?
Correct.
Okay.
So there's a big Y that's in the middle of Canyonlands National Park as the Green and the Colorado come together and then go south.
Right.
Mostly south. And on the east side of all of the rivers is the Needles. Between the two rivers is the Island in the Sky District.
Okay.
And on the west side of the Green River and then Colorado where they've joined together is the Maze District. And it's the most remote district and the most undeveloped district.
Okay.
And so I was stationed at a place called Hams Flat, which is up on top of the Orange Cliffs, kind of west of the Maze proper.
Is that and spelled H-A-N-S?
H-A-N-S, right.
Okay.
Flat. And I think, so there's a little strip of Glen Canyon National Recreation Area that runs up the west side there.
That's right.
And I think they manage what they call the Orange Cliffs, which is that higher chunk of land and that Hams Flat was on. And I'm not sure if we were on, whether it still extended clear up the Hams Flat or not. I think we were just an isolated little island of Park Service administrative area surrounded by BLM, but we could have been surrounded by Glen Canyon up there. So you would drive south along the Orange Cliffs, go down the Flint Trail and drop down 1,000 feet or something like that, and then kind of drive in a northeast direction on a plateau level there. That was, let me think of that. I don't think it's equivalent to the White Rim around, I don't think it's the same as the White Rim level in the Island in the Sky that people now bicycle a lot.
Right, it's a little higher, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember, but roughly speaking, it's kind of a halfway plateau between those high Orange Cliffs and down in the Maze and down, certainly down into the river.
Right.
And so you could, there were road systems that went through there out to the Maze Overlook where you could hike down into the Maze proper, or you could take another fork and drive out the Standing Rocks, kind of go further east to some needles-like spires of rock that were isolated there. And you could end up at the Dollhouse, which is above Spanish Bottom.
Right. And then beyond that is the Fins. Oh, this is some amazing, amazing country out there.
Yeah, great, right. The Fins are on the southern part of the park there.
Yeah.
So my job, there was also the isolated Horseshoe Canyon component.
Okay, hold that thought for a minute. My job.
Okay.
Did they? So you went through a week's worth of training, and did they say, now go buy some groceries, because you're going to be out for a month or two?
Right. Well, it was a 3-hour drive to Moab.
Okay.
And I think we worked 10 days on and 4 days off.
So 3-hour drive to Moab, that would be from Moab, you have to drive to Green River, Utah, cross the river, and then head south toward Hanksville or something? How did that?
Yep, exactly.
Okay.
You went towards Hanksville, and then maybe 15 miles north of Hanksville on whatever road that is, you would turn east and go by the big flat tops and basically drive east to Hams Flat.
Okay.
And the total drive time from Moab to Hams Flat was roughly 3 hours.
And what was your day on, day off schedule?
I worked 10 days on and then 4 days off.
Okay.
So we bought 10 days worth of groceries when we were in town.
So you go to the city market there and
yes, which was in its so it's, I think it's moved 3 times that I can remember, but so it was 3 locations ago from what it is now.
Okay.
Yeah, City Market was the place, and get groceries and go out there. And then I would go on patrols. I would be assigned to patrol an area. The Park Service tried to have someone patrolling at Horseshoe Canyon daily because they have some really world-class pictograph panels there, and they didn't want them to be vandalized.
Yeah.
And they thought it was just good to have a presence in the canyon.
Mm-hmm.
So they might send me there just for a day, but they might send me there for 3 or 4 days.
Okay.
So it just kind of depended upon how, what was going on with the schedule.
Did you have your own backpack? Would they send you out with a truck or a backpack and just, well, here's, you know, load it
we
up
had
and...
trucks.
Okay.
Yeah, we had trucks. So mostly I would go to a place with the truck. And actually you could, so at that time you could drive down into Horseshoe Canyon and I would drive down in and just set up my camp out of the truck there and just be there pretty much. I would hike up to the pictographs, and then I would hike back. And if I saw people, I would talk to them. I didn't see a lot of people there. It wasn't like it's a place that's real crowded. It was visited, but it wasn't heavily visited.
Yeah, this is like Moab in, you know, 1977, 78. I'm like, you lucky woman.
right, exactly. So that was one place I would go. I might be assigned to go into the maze.
Okay.
So then I would drive a vehicle down to the maze overlook and hike into the maze and hike around there for 3 days maybe or 4 days, whatever, you know, whatever was in the schedule. So that would be a backpack trip. Or I might go be sent to the Standing Rocks, the land of Standing Rocks, which you could drive out, and we would just basically car camp there at the Dollhouse or other places. And do day hikes into different areas like the Fins or Water Canyon or different locations from
Did
there.
You hike down to Spanish Bottom?
Yes.
Okay, so you would have
which
been...
Is,
Go
which
ahead.
Which is instrumental in my story of how I became a river ranger later. I'll get to that. But
okay.
Yes, we would hike down to Spanish Bottom and just do... Probably, I probably spend the night down there. So especially if the river crew was coming along, I would be hiking down to Spanish Bottom sometimes to rendezvous with the river crew because there was the three districts that were the land districts, and then there was a fourth district in the park or a sub-district at the time, I think, that
mm-hmm.
was the river. And there were river rangers that lived in Moab and did patrols.
Right.
And once I started knowing people a little bit, if I had heard that the river rangers were doing a patrol through Cataract and I was going to be down in the Dollhouse area, I don't think I did it a lot, but at least a couple times, I think, I hiked down and camped with them. You know, I had a great meal on the river and socialized. And one of those times, it must have been June or something. It was hot, and that Dollhouse Trail down to Spanish Bottom is east facing, and in the morning they just toss all their stuff in the boats and go splashing down the river, and I heave my 45-pound pack on and walk up the Dollhouse Trail with the sun hitting full blast on that face, and I thought to my, I can remember thinking, why am I a backpacking ranger when this river thing looks like it's so much fun? And I can remember thinking, I don't think I really like backpacking that much anymore. I think I don't want to do it anymore. And I just remember that. I couldn't tell you if that was, so I was in the...
Another SCA bites the dust going, hey.
Actually, I'm way ahead of the story now because what happened was when I was an SCA, I later came back for 2 seasons as a seasonal there. So
okay.
It was in one of my seasons as a seasonal when that episode happened.
Okay.
But the first 3 months I was an SCA with the kind of tasks that I described. Really, I did the same work as a seasonal work. When I came back later as a seasonal, it was the same stuff.
Right.
And then after I was an SCA there for 3 months, I had this summer trip that I had heard of in Oregon, at Oregon State. Some of the professors said, we're going to try and put the together this trip to go visit national parks in South America.
Wow.
Who wants to sign up? And I went, I do. And so I talked my parents into covering the cost of this trip as a graduation present. And
nice.
So I had signed up for this trip that left from Miami. We met in somewhere in Miami, and we first went to Everglades, and we went to Biscayne Bay, and then from there, I think we spent, I don't remember how long the trip was, maybe a month, maybe, I can't remember now, but we went to Panama, I used to know this all, now I'm forgetting. I know we went to Panama, Venezuela, Brazil, Paraguay, and that might have been it, in Costa Rica, I think.
Okay.
And then we returned to Miami. So I ended up, after I was in the maze, driving my Volkswagen Bug to Miami and meeting this group there and doing this trip to South America to look at parks. And so it was kind of interesting to me from the park perspective, but it also was just travel, and I loved the idea of traveling and seeing the world. So, you know, I had multiple motives, or
yeah.
I guess maybe two motives. And then I flew back into Florida and drove back to the West, and that kind of took the bulk of the summer. I'm sure I had a few weeks on each end, but what I had done was signed up to be a SCA again in the fall in Canyonland, since I still didn't have a job that paid any money and I didn't have anything scheduled for the fall. I said, great, well, maybe I'll be a SCA again. So they hired me on as a SCA, and this time I was in the Needles.
Okay.
So fall of 77, I was an SCA in the Needles District, which had, one of the things I forgot when I was in the maze was that I did spend time in what they called the contact station there. So they had a little trailer where people would stop and get permits to go into the maze, and we would tell them stuff about where water was and what the road was like. And so that was another one of my tasks there. And in the Needles, it was kind of similar that I would be in the contact station, which was a little trailer, or we would be out on some kind of a patrol, which might be a driving around or a Jeep patrol or a backpacking patrol. But it seems like I backpacked less there. It seems like I was more in a vehicle or in the contact station. Although what happened was that I was SCA there for 2 months, and then during my third month, a maintenance worker had quit or somehow was a vacancy in maintenance, and they decided they needed this laborer, and so they did an emergency hire and hired me on as a maintenance laborer, and so I was officially paid at that point and no longer doing ranger kinds of things. I was doing things like painting the outhouse.
Okay.
And I don't even remember, maybe helping other maintenance guys with whatever jobs in the Needles District they needed to be tending to and needed someone to hold the other end of the 2x4 or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
It was easy and fairly lightweight stuff, but I was thrilled to have a paying job.
Yeah. Can you tell me a little bit more about the concept of the SCAs? Because I'm thinking about seasonal 180-day job that doesn't go beyond 180 days, except in this case, the park doesn't have to pay anything except food and lodging, a place to stay.
Right.
So it's really financially beneficial to the park. And you're right. They give you an area to do a rove in. They probably give you a radio.
Yep.
To stay in touch, and so you really are a seasonal that doesn't cost anybody anything.
Right, right. And it's actually supposed to be where you are giving people some experience in what it's like to work in the park and to have ability to gain some skills while doing that. So it's not just that the park benefits. The SCA is also supposed to benefit by gaining some skills from their real-world adventure working in a park.
Right, okay.
it's funded by something called the Student Conservation Association, who does look for grants. I don't know about grants, actually. I suspect grants, but donations, and they get funding from somewhere. I don't know where. Donations, grants,
mm-hmm.
funding. And then the SCA program will be in touch with parks and say, do you have positions that you'd like to fill? And they coordinate, you know, how much money do we have and how many positions can we cover,
right.
With different parks. And so they will agree to fund six 3-month positions in a park, or 12, maybe 3 each season or something like that. And so the park kind of knows that going year after year and just incorporates that employee or that volunteer pool into the whole work staff.
And I would assume that the park, the seasonals and the permanents get a chance to look at the SCA people and say, oh, we would like that person to work for us. Oh, we would not like that person to work for us.
Exactly. Yeah.
So they get a little exposure.
It was a foot in the door.
Yeah,
foot in the door for me. So
right.
that after I was at SCA in the Needles, then I applied the next season in the winter, whenever the applications were being accepted, to be a seasonal in Canyonlands. And I was offered a seasonal job in the Mays District, at that time, I don't think there was the 180-day limitation.
Okay.
There might have been some limitations, but it was a long season. I think it was 7 months first year. It might have been even verging on 8 months. So I was offered that seasonal job in the Mays District. And I'm 100% positive it's because I had been an SCA there. They knew who I was.
Right.
They knew that I could do the job. And I knew what the job was. And so it was at that point, it was a good fit. So
let's go back.
Paid off.
Now that we've got that kind of landscape mapped out, you mentioned that your second SCA stint a couple months out, there was this emergency hire came up for maintenance. How long did that last?
It was just 30 days.
Oh, okay. So you got a month's worth of pay.
Right, right. Yeah.
And so then did you say, all right, I want to apply for a seasonal term then?
Yeah, so that would have taken me into, I think it was September, October. It might have been about the middle of November or maybe November 10th that this whole SCA and then 30-day emergency hire thing
mm-hmm.
ended. I can remember doing a backpacking trip in Grand Gulch at
Ooh.
The end of that, and it was freezing cold. And then I was basically didn't have a job for the winter. So I had applied for a job for the next summer or for the year of 78 as a seasonal in Canyonlands. But I ended up going back to Oregon and waitressing in Corvallis, Oregon during the winter and living at my dad's house because, you know, I didn't have a job.
Yeah. Okay. And so was that, I mean, I would assume that might have been kind of depressing. I mean, I'm just because it's gray skies and you got a job waitressing. That's nice, but the desert's out there and you don't have a seasonal job yet.
It wasn't terribly depressing. I don't remember being terribly depressed. It was like I didn't have a lot of options.
Yeah,
it was nice to have a job. It was nice to have a cheap place to live, like no rent because I was at my dad's house.
Yeah.
And I think that I must have been optimistic that I would get a job in Canyonlands and so not be stuck there forever.
Mm.
So I don't, you know, and then I got to be home for the holidays. So I'm not sure that I don't remember being depressed about it. I think it was what it was.
Okay. All right. It was working out.
I got a job offer and I was all excited and went back to Moab.
So then you would have filled out some sort of paperwork. For that,
right?
Did you fill out applications for any other parks, for any other seasonal jobs?
I don't remember.
Okay.
I probably did just because that would have been the smart thing to do is cover your bases in case something went awry in Canyonlands. But I honestly can't remember.
Okay. And then when did that job start in 1978?
It was. Like I said, it was a long season, so I'm think that I might have, it was probably sometime in March, maybe the first week of March.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, and I think it went into most of October or through most of October. So I think it was March through October, roughly speaking.
Okay. You know, Pat, we've been talking for almost an hour, not quite. I'm wondering if this might be a good place to stop this interview, and we'll pick it up again when you leave Corvallis and head to Canyonlands for that your first seasonal job in 1978.
Sure. That sounds great.
Okay. Do you have anything else you want to add to this section that we haven't covered that you think we should?
I don't think so. I think I don't have anything else to add.
Okay.
If I think of anything overnight or whenever, we can throw it out then tomorrow morning. But I think that's really pretty thorough.
Good. Okay. Well, I always ask. I'm just like, No, I wanted to tell you about, you know, this happened and that was way back in there when I was in high school or whatever.
Right.
And, you know,
right.
So we can catch that. And well, with that, this will conclude part one, oral history with Pat Gredigan. Today is Tuesday, November 17th, 2020. My name is Tom Martin, and Pat, thank you so very much.
You're very welcome.